crackdown. More than 400 people have been killed since the protests began, including over 100 on Monday alone. In southwestern Bangladesh, 24 people died on Monday when a hotel was set on fire. The hotel was owned by a political associate of Sheikh Hasina. After she fled the country, protesters stormed her official residence. For more, we're joined in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, by Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression. She served as Secretary General of Amnesty International from 2001 to 2009. Irene Khan, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what has happened in your country.
Well, thank you for inviting me to your program. What is happening here is quite extraordinary. As you said, a student uprising that actually began about quotas for government jobs has turned into a mass popular movement for democracy. The prime minister fled the country yesterday in a remarkable short time. And now we have an army chief and the president here in the country who are trying to put together an interim government. On the other hand, we have hundreds of thousands of people who turned up on the streets to celebrate yesterday in Dhaka itself, and millions around the country who want to have a smooth transition to democracy, but not more of the same. And that is where the students come in with their request for the Nobel laureate Yunus, because for the students, the struggle is about equality. They call themselves now the non-discrimination movement. So they want equality, they want justice, they want accountability for the 400 people who've been killed, 10,000 people put in jail, thousands injured, and so on. But we are at a very risky, in a very risky situation. We want change, but who is going to bring the change? There is an army chief who effectively took over from Hasina, and his job is to set up an interim government. But, you know, the armed forces, the law enforcement, they were only last week actually shooting at people. Of course, the risks are there. As you mentioned, the hotel, there has been a lot of retaliatory attacks, unfortunately, on the Hindu minority, who are seen to have been close to Hasina's government. A number of reports are coming in about temples having been attacked, property being burned. Last night, I myself heard in a slum down the road from where I live, people screaming and shouting as some of these goons came in and broke their property. So there's a lot of this revenge killing going on. There is an army chief. It's not clear exactly in which direction he will go. And then there are these students who are demanding something that hasn't happened before. They're not asking for political parties. They're actually asking to have an interim government led by a civil society leader who is very highly regarded in this country, and they are looking for justice. They're looking for human rights, actually, a human rights approach. So whether that will happen, of course, remains to be seen, but we are very, all of us are behind that. At least I am behind that move of putting human rights front and center in this struggle.
Well, I'd like to bring in Tanjib Arnav, one of the student protesters who has been fighting for democracy in Bangladesh. Tanjib, talk to us about the protests, your expectations now that the government has fallen.
What are we expecting is an interim government that will listen to us, that will listen to our students. Because when the military chief held the meeting with the military chief held meetings with all of the political parties, but they excluded us. So now the protester, the common students, has taken on the social media again, and we demanded that the previous parliament had to be broken down before 3 p.m. Bangladesh time. They have broken down the government, but we don't know who's going to be in charge of the interim government. We are expecting and we are hoping, we the general students, one, Dr. Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, to be the chief advisor of the interim government. And we also expect to have a thorough investigation of all the killings, which includes the police officers, which includes the students, which includes the general people, And we want everyone who killed anyone or vandalized any property to face the court and face justice. We don't want anyone to die anymore on the streets. And we want the military or the interim government to take proper steps to ensure safety on the roads.
Tanjib Ashab Arnab, if you can explain why this started with the students, tens of thousands of people in the streets, 400 people have been killed, how many arrested, and what's your message to the international community?
So, okay, my message to first of all, we took the streets. It started with the students because the job quota movement. There was a 56% quota on the national services of Bangladeshi job sectors. And we wanted to abolish that, which in that 56, if you break down that 56%, you would have 30% that belong to the grandchildren of freedom fighters. And we didn't want that. We thought that it was unfair to give 30% of quota to such a small population, which doesn't, who weren't suppressed. There are other people who need help. And another part of it was when we took on the streets of our without fair demands, the government, especially Ubaidul Qadir and other prime minister, they ridiculed us. They wanted to attack us. They attacked us with the student's body. The student body was armed and they took on my unarmed brothers and sisters in Dhaka University. And another part of it was that the people of this country, we are actually fed up of the autocratic government led by Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. We are fed up. If you speak up in this country, you will be arrested. Wrapped guilt people that we don't know. There has been people who were arrested 5 or 6 years ago. We don't know where they are, what happened to them. There are many unnamed killings. We wanted proper response from the government. There were students who were unarmed killed by police officers. And when we saw those, we couldn't stay at our homes because the person I was in the same class with, the person who went to the same college with me, were getting killed or were getting attacked in other part of the country. And we, the students, had to take on the streets and protest.
I'd like to ask Irene Han if you could talk about the Sheikh. Hasina was seen herself as a pro-democracy advocate when she first came to power. What happened to her and to her regime, and what will be her legacy?
Well, she is the daughter of the founding father of this country, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman. She was also the prime minister who signed all the international human rights instruments on behalf of Bangladesh when she came to power in 2001. But over the last 15 years or so, she became a dictator, authoritarian. She rigged three elections one after the other, depriving people of their right to vote. And very dangerously, her party captured all the state institutions, the police, the army, the judiciary, even the media, independent media journalists were either killed, threatened, editors had cases brought against them. So basically, she destroyed all the pillars of democracy and lost touch with the needs of the people. At a time when the country was going through economic growth, but that economic growth did not benefit ordinary people. So there was inequality, and there is a lot of inequality in the country where former prime minister and her cronies got richer and richer, and a lot of other people got poorer and poorer. And as the student leader just explained, young people felt deprived of opportunity, felt ignored. And there was this sort of big bomb waiting to explode. And that's precisely what happened. The tinder was the issue of the job quotas. But there was a lot more anger, frustration, disappointment behind that.
And the significance of her fleeing to India?
Well, I think it is interesting because India is a neighboring country, has been supportive of Bangladesh's independence, for example. But over the last decade and more, it has been very close, worked very closely with the Awami League government. And many people in this country would say that India's support allowed her to retain her power for so long. Now, of course, India has a choice. India has given her a temporary, I understand it's temporary, I don't know, stay there. But the more important question is that how India will view the uprising, the people's demand in Bangladesh for change. I hope that the Indian government has watched how hundreds and thousands, millions of people came out in the street yesterday, and that they will respect the wishes of the people.
I wanted to ask you a final question, Irene Khan. You are the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression. Earlier today, you issued a statement condemning the Israeli military killing of the Al Jazeera journalist Ismail Al-Ghul and the cameraman Rami Al-Rifi in Gaza. Can you talk more about their deaths and overall the number of journalists, well over 100, who've been killed in Gaza?
Yes, I have been very disturbed by the high number of killings of journalists in this war. As you know, the Committee on the Protection of Journalists and other organizations that collect this data say that this is the most dangerous conflict for journalists in the last 30 years since statistics have been kept. And part of it is, of course, the intensity of the war. But what I'm seeing also is a pattern in which journalists are being targeted. Now, most of the journalists on the ground in Gaza, almost all, not most, they are all Gazans, because Israel has refused to allow foreign media into the country, into Gaza. So you have these local journalists who are working on behalf sometimes of international outlets, sometimes other outlets, who are being targeted. And in this particular case, they were traveling in a car marked press. They were wearing jackets marked press, and they were attacked. And this is not the first incident like that. We have seen several incidents like that, one that was investigated earlier this year by the Washington Post, and where the Post had the opportunity to examine the video material from the Israeli Defense Force. And it was clear that these people were journalists doing journalistic activities, and they were killed with drones. So what I see is a very dangerous act here. Journalists are civilians. The deliberate targeting of journalists is a war crime. Israel has to be held accountable for that. These journalists are our lifeline for communication on what is happening there. So if they get killed, they can't do their job. It also covers up the terrible atrocities that are happening there.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Irene Khan, UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, former head of Amnesty International, speaking to us from Dhaka, from her country of Bangladesh, where the prime minister has just fled. And I want to thank Tanjim Ashab Arnab, a student at Brock University. He is participating in the student-led protests that have resulted in the prime minister's resignation. Next up, it's primary day in Missouri here in the United States. Stay with us. Instrumental, Cannibal Ox. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today is primary day in Missouri, one of the most closely watched races of the year. Democratic Congressmember Cori Bush is facing off against County Prosecutor Wesley Bell. APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and an affiliated super PAC have spent over $8 million in an effort to defeat Bush, who's been a vocal critic of Israel's war on Gaza. The election comes just weeks after the same super PAC, United Democratic Project, spent over $14 million to help defeat New York Congressmember Jamal Bowman in his Democratic primary here in New York. 4 years ago, Cori Bush won a stunning primary upset over the 10-term incumbent, Congressmember William Lacy Clay Jr. in Missouri's 1st Congressional District in the St. Louis area. Bush was a leader in the 2014 Ferguson uprising over the police killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown. Prior to taking office, she worked as a nurse. She was also unhoused for a period of time with her children, an experience that led her to become a leading housing advocate in Congress, where she introduced the Unhoused Bill of Rights. We go right now to St. Louis. We're joined by Michael Berg, former political director of the Missouri chapter of the Sierra Club. He has a new piece for The Nation headlined, "I'm a St. Louis Jew. Here's why I'm backing Cori Bush. If AIPAC and its donors defeat her, we won't just be losing one of Palestine's staunchest allies, but also one of the climate movement's most effective champions." Michael Berg, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what's happening in St. Louis now with this massive amount of money that's being put in to defeat Congressmember Bush.
Thank you, Amy. Yes, if you're in St. Louis and you live here over the last several weeks, couple months, you look at YouTube, you'll see an advertisement either against Cori Bush, a lot of them against Cori Bush, or for Wesley Bell. You go to your television, you hear that. You go to the radio. You get mailers. There's been talk to people who have had over 40 mailers, either anti-Bush or pro-Bell, coming in. It's just this incredible infusion of money and resources in attacking Bush and supporting Bell. And it's interesting because, as you mentioned, the money is coming from AIPAC, but the attacks have nothing to do with her principled stance for a ceasefire. There are about other very, very misleading attacks on her coming in, and it's all meant to push out someone who stands up for Palestinian rights, but who stands up for so many other things. But it's very duplicitous for this organization to come in and have the money for one reason and have all these ads that are misleading for other reasons.
And, Michael, what's been the stance of the existing Democratic Party machinery, which normally backs an incumbent?
Well, if you look at the national level, Cori Bush is backed by Hakeem Jeffries and the leadership in Congress, the Progressive Caucus, the Black Caucus. I mean, you have Democrats in the state of Missouri in the area who are on both sides of this race. So I can't say there's a unified response, but there is, the union movement, most unions are supporting Bush. She's voted with the AFL-CIO almost 100% of the time. There's trades have been on the other side, but the other unions have not. So I'd say there's been people on different sides. But the primary thing happening is just this incredible infusion of AIPAC money that's sort of washed, like just dominated the airways. And people keep hearing it. And seeing it, and I've hit a lot of doors, knocked a lot of doors, and it has its effect. Misleading statements about her record as far as the infrastructure bill, where she made a principled stance to hold out to make sure there's a child tax credit, to make sure we had more climate provisions, a stance that was taken in 2021, where she stood up and she took a vote. And in the 2022 election, almost nobody heard about it. But here in the 2024 election, just the airwaves and the mailers are just hammering, saying she didn't stand up for your job. She didn't stand up for clean air and water. And there's nothing further from this truth. She was standing up for many times as much. And what I found is, I knock on doors and people have heard these things. And you talk to them and say, I don't support her anymore because she didn't do this. And when you explain that, no, she was holding out to get more resources for your children, to make sure we much more further confronted the climate crisis. And the only reason you're hearing about it now is because she stood up for peace in the Middle East, for a ceasefire, for children to stop being killed with American weapons, and that because of that, you have millions of dollars coming heavily from the same donors who backed Trump, Vance, and Senator Hawley. When you let people know that, and that you say, why are you hearing so much about this? It's because people don't want her there. You flip the vote. People then support her again. But the problem being, you know, who's got the capacity to go to every door and have a 5 to 10 minute conversation? The barrage of misinformation works, and we're hopeful. We're hoping we can counteract it, but it's been never seen anything like it.
And what about Wesley Bell, the St. Louis County prosecuting attorney? He previously served on the city council and was instrumental in policy changes after the police killing of Michael Brown. What's been the sentiment of voters toward him, or do people even really know him?
A lot of people know him. I mean, it's different. It's St. Louis is kind of confusing jurisdiction. So St. Louis County is outside of St. Louis City. So he's the prosecutor for St. Louis County. The district, Cori Bush's district, is about half the city of St. Louis and half parts of St. Louis County. People know him. And I would say, you know, what is disturbing to me is he told Congresswoman Bush that he was not going to run. He told her that. He was running against Josh Hawley, our senator, who is not very popular in this district. And he said he was running against him. And then when he was offered a deal to get millions of dollars of AIPAC money, he did a 180 and decided to take on, you know, an incumbent progressive Democrat who's just been a champion, as I mentioned in my article, for the climate, for so many things that people care about in this area. So I would call him an opportunist who saw an opportunity to go to Congress, while Cori Bush is in it because she wants to represent the interests of ordinary people, the people who are suffering, people who are unhoused. Before she came into office, she was constantly on the streets helping folks who are unhoused, making sure people had resources, food and shelter when need be. So I see a clear distinction there.
Michael Berg, I want to thank you so much for being with us. St. Louis Jewish supporter of Cori Bush, former political director of the Missouri chapter of the Sierra Club. We'll link to your piece in The Nation. I'm a St. Louis Jew. Here's why I'm backing Cori Bush. And of course, we'll report on the results of the election, the primary, tomorrow. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with the historic $2 billion payout by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to black farmers and other farmers of color who experienced discrimination when applying to the USDA's farm loan programs. The payouts finally came 2 years after Congress funded them through the Inflation Reduction Act in 2022. USDA Secretary, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack made the announcement last week.
Now, this financial assistance is not compensation for anyone's loss or the pain endured, but it is an acknowledgement by the department. And our hope is, and the president's hope is, that this financial assistance will help many farmers stay on the farm, contribute to our nation's food supply, and continue to do what they love.
This comes after the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights confirmed, as long ago as 1965, that the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, discriminated against black farmers. But little was done to address the problem, and the number of black-run farms dropped 96% in the last century. By 1999, 98% of all agricultural land was owned by white people. For more, we go to Boydton, Virginia. We're joined by John Boyd, a fourth-generation black farmer and founder and president of the nonprofit National Black Farmers Association, which fought for these payouts that have now gone out. John, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Explain the significance of what's happening right now.
Amy, thank you so much for having me, and it's always good to spend time with you. This is a very, very historic payout for black farmers, and I see it as a huge win for myself and the National Black Farmers Association that worked on this for nearly four decades. So basically, 60,000 applications were turned in, 45,000 Black farmers and other farmers of color have begun receiving checks this week and the latter part of last week. So it's very, very good news, and a total of $2 billion. So we've been waiting for this payout for a long time. And the MBFA went out and held 60 meetings in FaceTime with our members. We sent out 130,000 postcards in the mail to all of our members, telling them how to apply for this. It took us, Amy, on average 3 to 3.5 hours to help each and every Black farmer fill out this 40-page application. So it was a very extensive process. And so we were glad to get the news that from Stephen Benjamin at the White House actually called me and told me that the checks were actually going out to farmers around the country. So we see this as a huge significance of farmers who are facing foreclosure. We have a lot of Black farmers in our organization that were facing foreclosure. So these payments are timely. It's going to help them stay on the farm or help them improve the equipment, help them pay taxes. And I'm not saying it's a whole holistic fix, but it's certainly a huge thumb up for us. And Amy, we're still pushing for the $5 billion in debt relief. So I'm asking the administration to do that by executive order. That's what I've been having conversations with the White House to still get the $5 billion. That's the land that's owned by many Black farmers that have their deeds of trust tied up with the United States Department of Agriculture. And again, that's a decade old request as well.
And could you explain the difference between the payments and the debt relief?
Absolutely. The payments, like you heard Secretary Vilsack mention, it was those Black farmers and farmers of color who experienced discrimination prior to 2021. So that was just about everybody in our organization that fit that definition. So that piece was totally separate than the actual debt relief, which is 120% we were promised. Black farmers who were eligible for that were sent the necessary form in the mail telling them how much debt relief they were going to get and the 20% to pay their taxes. All of our members sent them back in. And then after that, white farmers started suing us in federal court around the country in numerous federal courts and two temporary injunctions, one in Florida and the other in Texas, blocking the $5 billion in debt relief to Black and other farmers of color. And then we began to file motions in federal court. And after we began to make some traction there, a few wins, the administration repealed it by an act of Congress and replaced it with some of these other measures. So we still want our land, like you talked about at the beginning of the show. We've, at the turn of the century, owned 20 million acres of land. Today, we're down, as Black farmers, 3.5 million acres. At the turn of the century, we were tilling, there were 1 million Black farm families in the United States. Today, we're down to about 50,000 full-time Black farmers. So the land, as my daddy and grandfather taught me, the land is everything. The land is food. The land is water. The land is timber to build houses on. Everything comes great from the land, and we want our land. And that's what I've been after for this whole campaign, and I spoke to you about it before.
John, you mentioned your father. You are a fourth-generation Black farmer. Can you describe your own experience of discrimination? You don't often talk about that in your national interviews.
You're right. And I want to give a thumbs up to my daddy, the greatest man I knew in the flesh. Not because he had any money, but because the way he carried himself. He was a dignified, humble Black farmer that worked hard every day. Every day that pickup truck rolled in the turn, man, he was ready to go to work. And we worked sun up to sundown together and said very few words. But the discrimination that I faced at USDA was in-your-face discrimination. I was spat on with tobacco juice running down my shirt on one particular loan application with the lender, who was a federal employee who was employed by a government. Spat on me. I was called the N-word from this same official. I had my application torn up and thrown in a trash can in front of me. On average, it took 387 days to process a Black farmer's loan request. less than 30 days to process a right farmer's loan request. In that particular county, this person would only see black farmers one day of the week. So we named it Black Wednesday. And we all would be in the hallway trying to apply for loans. And one day we all just looked at our letters from USDA, and it said 9 a.m. Wednesday. For all of us, he's going to see us all.